This is Romany Arrowsmith from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Glamour and Rookie magazines. The theme for today is first loves. And the first article I have for you is from Glamour magazine, and it's a little bit of a light piece called An Ode to Keanu Reeves, the One Man in Hollywood We Can All Agree On, by Jessica Radloff. With news that Matrix 4 is officially a go, and with Keanu Reeves reprising the lead role no less, we thought now was as good a time as ever to remind you that Reeves is the best. Our original post, which was published in June 2019, can be found below. Recently, Keanu Reeves reportedly revealed in an interview that he's a lonely guy. "I don't have anyone in my life," he added, "but if it does occur, I would respect and love the other person. Hopefully, it'll happen for me." The story quickly went viral because, duh, Keanu Reeves, a national and cinematic treasure, is lonely? If that's true, I volunteer as tribute to keep him company. I'd cook Alison Roman's spicy chickpea stew while we heart-to-heart about, like, where our souls go when we die. We'd have a really nice time, I think. Others on social media definitely feel the same way. It's heartbreaking to think Reeves is lonely because, like Tom Hanks and Chris Evans, he's on a very short list of universally beloved men. He's found a respectful way to pose with female fans for photos. There are multiple articles with the headline, "Proof that Keanu Reeves is the nicest guy in Hollywood," which is enough proof for me that he's the nicest guy in Hollywood. His work is so iconic that a hip New York City theater hosted a retrospective of his films this summer. In April, Glasgow threw a KeanuCon festival. Even Sandy Bullock, literally Miss Congeniality, has a crush on him. The good news. His representative told Huffington Post the interview was fabricated. Thank God Reeves is doing just fine, but the story did lead to an interesting discussion on social media and among the Glamour team about his allure. When I dropped the article into Slack, a conversation with my coworkers about how much we love Reeves quickly took off. Kaliha Hawkins pointed to a lesser-known Reeves film, 1995's A Walk in the Clouds, as proof of his versatility as an actor. "Keanu is known for his action roles, but he's always been a rom-com star in my mind," she said. "A Walk in the Clouds is full of drama and rom-com tropes, so this movie has it all." Samantha Leach said she keeps seeing nostalgic photos of Reeves in her Instagram feed, to her delight. If you're deep down the rabbit hole of 90s nostalgia Instagram like I am, photos of Keanu Reeves in River Phoenix around the time of My Own Private Idaho pop up a lot, she told me. The smolder that guy gives off as a 90s indie star is unreal. Like, come on. More important, whenever he's pictured with River Phoenix, he looks so protective of him. River was struggling with addiction by that point, and with every pose, Keanu looks like he's trying to convey, "Let me save you, River," through his eyes. It's how much he cares that truly makes him sexy. For Kim Fusaro, the love for Reeves started early and hasn't wavered. "I saw Keanu in Point Break in the theater because my friend's mom escorted us, two preteens, to the counter and cleared us for tickets. It was my first in-the-theater rated R movie," she said. "A decade later, I went with the same friend to see Keanu's band Dog Star at a small Providence bar, another venue that we definitely weren't old enough to be in. He was worth bending the rules and breaking the law for. I didn't know Reeves had a band, but it only adds to his charm. That surprising side of Reeves is what Christopher Rosa likes too. He's a great actor, and so, so hot. But my love for him is rooted in something else entirely. Conspiracy theories," Rosa said. "There are so many wild rumors about Reeves on the internet, and they're either all true or all complete nonsense. Like this one about how he paid for a stranger's kidney transplant, or when everyone was convinced he saved dozens of cats from euthanasia. And there's the old folklore that he drives a Honda and lives in a normal apartment despite having millions. We do know he takes the subway, so perhaps that last one is true. Regardless, the internet is out here posting theories about him like he's a Game of Thrones character, and I'm here for it." Anna Kalon insisted we all watch BuzzFeed's puppy interview with Reeves, which she described as a delight. It's particularly noteworthy because, one, he was able to stay more focused than other participants, and two, his answers range from adorably punny to deep and sincere. Gravity helps him stay down to earth, for example. He's a self-identified Edward Deverian, so he'd like to time travel back to the time of Shakespeare to see who's really responsible for those contributions to literature. I ask you, whomst? I could write 3,000 more words about Reeves' greatness. His chill reaction to the sad Keanu memes. The movie Keanu, in which he voices an adorable kitten. The time he reportedly found an intruder in his library and calmly talked to her until the cops arrived. Everything about the John Wick movies. But I'll end this ode by praising Reeves' recent memorable appearance as a highly fictionalized version of himself in Always Be My Maybe, Ali Wong's Netflix romantic comedy. He was Wong and director Nanachna Khan's first choice for the part, a love interest for Wong's character. But even they were surprised by how game he was to do it. We all thought it was going to be impossible to get him, Randall Park, who also stars in the movie, told Vulture. What was the likelihood of him being available, and then also him being willing to play himself? The scenes are wild to watch. He is Keanu Reeves, sure, but this character is more of a parody of what a fan might think weird, out-of-touch celebrities are like than anything grounded in reality. He's the kind of guy who goes to a fancy restaurant and orders dishes that play with the concept of time. This version of Reeves is not a good guy. Another reason it's clearly fiction, but he's still fascinating. You want to be around him, even if his idea of a fun game night is deeply concerning. I truly think this will go down as one of his best roles. The part lets Reeves show a comedic side we rarely get to see while playing on the mysterious allure of his personal life and celebrity. It's brilliantly written, and he's brilliant in it. All this is to say, we love you, Keanu Reeves. This next article, also about first loves, literally called How to Let Go of Your First Love from Rookie Magazine, and this one is written by Reva Billows. I was 17 when I fell in love for the first time. It felt like all of the movies, TV shows, and love songs finally made sense. Jim confessing his love to Pam in the office? Yup. When the Beach Boys sang, God only knows what I'd be without you? You bet. While I knew the success rate of high school relationships was low, both hormones and love's disorienting effects made me think, this could be it. When my partner and I broke up a year and a half later, it hit me that the very first person you love is usually just that, the first. I felt stuck in cynicism and sadness for about a year. The notion that love is not eternal is not shocking, nor original. So why do I still struggle to grasp it? It makes sense intellectually, but how do you accept it emotionally? I've spent the past year thinking about how to let go of a first love and why it would warrant a different guide from getting over a first breakup. Both involve crying and anger and complicated emotions, but you may not feel like you've had your first love till your third or fourth or fifth relationship. A first love could also look like something that never became an official relationship at all. Something unrequited, or something that was always meant to be temporary. Something that ended because of external factors like graduating and moving away, or just a bad match. You're both growing and changing so much, rather than either person being particularly cruel. When you're left with less, holy crap, that was very unhealthy, and more, life's tide is taking us in different directions, wah. But there are lots of rookie articles about other kinds of heartbreak, too. And hey, many of them have overlap, so if you are also feeling achy for a first love, here are some things to remember, chosen with care, to help you soothe, heal, and ultimately move forward. 1. Welcome this new feeling, heartbreak, and know that the newness is part of why it hurts. A month after that breakup, I went to a party, slept in a bed with a near stranger, woke up the next morning, and melodramatically cried that losing my first love would be a lifelong pain. A year later, this turned out to not be true. Every relationship you're in will be vibrant in its own special way. But first loves are extra easy to romanticize. You'd never been in love before, and extra hard to move on from. You'd never been heartbroken before. Being able to attribute your grief to the newness of it all can be kind of a bummer. We all want our feelings and experiences to be special. But let it bring comfort that no person or event is powerful enough to make you feel this bad all on their own. Which brings us to another reason why you feel extra crummy. Nostalgia. 2. Separate longing for a person from longing for a period of time, or resist nostalgia. A couple of weeks ago, I was talking to a friend who had recently returned home from a long trip. She said that the thought of her in those places now made her upset. When I asked her why, she paused, then said, "Because that was me there." I think this idea of it being you there is the achiest part of things ending. It's not so much the person you were with or the place where you were, but the fact that it was you who wore those outfits, you who listened to those songs, you who looked at that person with love, and how wild it is that you don't do those things anymore. The etymology of nostalgia, pain plus return home, tells us that the feeling is less about the specifics of that home than the fact that you can't go back. Breakups make us more aware than usual of the passing of time and of our mortal inabilities to stop it. So before you get caught up in the memory collage of smells, songs, books, and phrases that remind you of the person you were, or the person you were with, and so the person you were, remember, nostalgia is powerful. It can convince us that things were better, easier, and more beautiful back then, when in reality it was just as hard to be a person then as it is now. This memory collage is not equal to how the whole of your relationship really felt. Simply reminding yourself of all that may not be enough to really internalize it. So you're going to need to actively counter the experience of nostalgia. Make a new collage of songs, movies, books, etc. that make you want to move on. For every playlist that reminds you of that person, there's another that will make you excited for the future. Ahem, Rookie has so many of them, like so many. When things have been hard, I found comfort in the words of poet David White. One of the difficulties of leaving a relationship is not leaving the person themselves. What's difficult is leaving the dreams that you shared together. And you know that somehow, no matter who you meet in your life in the future, and no matter what species of happiness you would share with them, you will never, ever share those particular dreams again with that particular tonality and coloration. Another way to counter the power of nostalgia is to humanize that period in your life. Go through your phone and see all the mundane stuff you screenshotted or annoying stuff in your calendar between all those now lovey-dovey memories. Or ask a friend to remind you of everything you were dealing with at that time that was actually hard, annoying, or just plain dull. The humbling reality of this time you've built up in your mind will prepare you for the next hard but ultimately helpful realization. Number 3, understand that you are both living, changing people. I dated someone new soon after my first breakup in a misguided attempt to remind myself that love was, in fact, real, and then went through an even worse breakup than the first. Because of how poorly I was treated in the new relationship, I immediately started romanticizing my first ex, thinking, well, XYZ wouldn't have done this to me. I started questioning the decision I made to end the first relationship, even though we had been broken up for almost a year. I was anxious for months. What if we were soulmates, and I had ruined the whole thing? What if you only get one big love, and this one was mine? I forgot that we were both real people who had changed in the time since our breakup. I needed to be reminded that the me who exists right now might not make sense with the him who exists right now. It demands less of our imaginations to dwell on the past than be open to the future. So along with indulging nostalgia, we question past decisions, harbor regrets, and remember the other person as who they were then, instead of who they are now. We can change so much in such a short amount of time. We understand that this includes personal style, taste in music, hobbies, etc. But we make an exception when we're trying to rewrite or relive the past, and want to believe that our needs and wants have not changed. If you're entertaining the possibility of getting back together with someone, it's easy to imagine things will go right back to how they were when they were good. When you're stuck questioning whether you made a mistake, remain diligent and practical. Ask yourself whether or not you and the other person would, and more importantly, should, reconnect. You can be both nostalgic and realistic, sentimental and self-protective. It's important to not only think about your feelings, but the other person's feelings. Would they appreciate you reaching out to him, or would it make it harder for them too? If you're plaguing yourself with the "but what if we were meant to be" question, tell a friend and set a date in the future. If you still feel the same on the previously decided date, reevaluate and potentially take action. I find that I usually have thoughts like those after I've just listened to our song or finished reading old letters, which, like, okay, obviously I'm going to be influenced by these reminders of a rich and full love. Those reminders are part of processing heartbreak, but they can't control your actions. It's normal and great to be porous and sensitive, especially in the wake of a breakup, but we can also remember that the relationship ended for a reason. That reason might bring shame or make us feel inadequate. Now to show you that there is nothing to be ashamed of. Number 4. Know that everyone is going through this too. Our culture puts a high premium on finding your soulmate and having a perfect relationship. This can make a breakup seem like a failure rather than a healthy, normal part of life, as if staying with someone you shouldn't be with is a sign of success. It's all too easy to feel alone and isolated in this experience, to convince yourself that you've been singled out. But the tender and most unifying aspect of having love fall apart is that it isn't just a thing that's happening to you. It's happening to both of you. Let it be what it was. In Blue Ways, Maggie Nelson writes that to wish to forget how much you loved someone, and then to actually forget, can feel at times like the slaughter of a beautiful bird who chose, by nothing short of grace, to make a habitat of your heart. Ah, my heart aches! While it is natural, and often easier, to wish to forget how much you loved someone, it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. In fact, denying any sadness rather than processing it will feel worse in the long run. To let go doesn't mean throwing away the pictures, burning the love letters, and giving away the birthday gifts. Nor does it mean building a shrine of them. It means gently holding on to those things while ultimately putting them out of sight. It is in this new space then that you can let the relationship be what it was, no more, no less. This moment is about learning to make peace with the fact that something beautiful and special can come to an end. When we don't make this peace, we become jaded. As bell hooks writes in All About Love, New Visions, young people are cynical about love. Ultimately, cynicism is the great mask of the disappointed and betrayed heart. Acknowledging when we are disappointed allows us to take off this mask. So does the moment when we stop dwelling on nostalgia and contend with the sides of ourselves that a breakup will expose. It's hard work, but you're a champ to start now, because while the first is uniquely painful, it will certainly not be the last. As David White said, you are not leaving. You're arriving. Welcome home. This next essay is also from Rookie Mag, but it's a little bit of a change of pace. It's about mothers, and for a lot of us, our mothers and fathers were our first loves before any boy or girl, other boy or girl, came into our life. So I thought this was relevant to our theme. This one's called Sick of It All by Naomi Morris. As a teenager, I sometimes heard statistics about cancer on the news, 1 in 5 people, etc. I hypothetically applied them to my own life, counting my closest friends and family members, and figuring out how many of us could be at risk. So I understood that at some point, it would become a reality for me, as it does for almost everyone. What isn't specified in those matter-of-fact quantifiable soundbites is how you actually deal with it when your own mother is diagnosed, as I found out at 19. I still can't tell you how my mom felt as she went through it herself, but I can tell you how it felt to be her daughter. I met my mom on April 24th, 1994. From then on, I saw her practically every day of my life. I could not have asked for better care. I was fed and clothed, and I grew up mostly unrestricted from the things that brought me pleasure. Mom read to me before bed, then bought me books to read myself. She instilled me with a love of books, which led me to pursue writing, and she never discouraged my career aspirations or scoffed at any of my other dreams. She was supportive of every new outlandish plan, detective, actor, dancer, psychologist, as if I were perfectly capable of anything. Last year, I moved to a college in a different city to study English. Mom drove me and my belongings the 130 miles in order to move me into my first home without her. I cried like a baby, but I was not a baby anymore. Just before my 20th birthday that first year at school, Mom had a routine mammogram and a small growth was found in her breast. About a month later, we found out it was cancerous. The way she relayed the diagnosis to me made everything seem relatively calm. This might have been because of the physical distance between me and my family. Mom didn't have to divulge every medical detail. In bits and pieces of phone conversations, Mom's faraway, fuzzy voice reassured me that the lump was small, that she was fine and taking it in stride. She repeated her doctor's comments, telling me how they could barely see the growth. Small, we thought, meant medically easier to deal with. The first step was an operation to have the growth removed and studied, as she told me before we changed the topic and talked about my life at school. The growth and the operation were not yet associated with cancer and were therefore minor. When we found out it was cancerous, Mom reassured me again that she would only need radiotherapy, a treatment that involves focusing beams of radiation at the body in order to damage the DNA of cancer cells. It is painless and has few side effects. Everything changed after another phone call at the end of that May, though. Mom told me that she would need not just radiotherapy, but months of chemotherapy as well. We knew that this is a much harsher treatment. Chemo involves a lot of painful medications, hospital visits, and blood tests, and its impact on the patient varies depending on each person and the stage of their cancer. For some people, it's basically a poison and takes a huge physical toll on them, and the list of side effects is long and scary. This process for Mom would finish just before Christmas. It was just becoming beastly hot outside as we spoke. I couldn't feel even a stray cool breeze in the stuffy student halls, let alone envision the winter. But Mom's final diagnosis hit me like a blast of cold wind. For the first time, I heard Mom struggle to answer when I asked if she would lose her hair. I couldn't see her face, but I knew she was trying not to cry. She said yes, and it sounded as if it hurt, like she was sorry for something she couldn't possibly help. At that point, that was the limit of our understanding of chemo. We didn't know much of what else it entailed, but we knew it wasn't minor anymore. I can't remember what we said to try and make ourselves feel better. The tangible fact of hair loss hit me hard. After we said goodbye, I cried and cried on my best friend Emily's bed while she held my leg. In some ways, it was a relief to keep my distance till the end of the semester, but I also felt the weight of not being there for Mom's first treatment. It was an otherwise normal Saturday until I talked to my dad about how everything had gone. He told me that she was sick and sleeping all day, and it really scared me. It took a while for me to accept what was happening. My fellow rookie staffer Brody, whose mom has also had cancer, said a similar thing, that it felt surreal. She told me this in one of a few conversations we had on Facebook during the early stages of Mom's diagnosis and treatment. When I read through them now, I wrote things down that I had either forgotten or blocked out. I regularly cried without shame on the train because I thought I should be allowed to. That if anyone around me knew the reason my face was red and wet, they would understand. I was frustrated by the lack of resources for someone like me or my brother or any child of anyone with cancer. I saw posters promoting breast cancer research and awareness everywhere that, ironically, I hadn't consciously noticed before. But where was anything showing me what it was actually like? I was scared of my parents' illness, and I didn't see any of that fear represented in the world around me, especially not in those obnoxious pink flyers. As Brody also said, awareness is great, but without practical help, you grow to resent it. And if no one could help me in functional ways, I needed to see and know that other people had been through the feelings Mom and I had. Pictures of survival were pleasant, but I wanted confirmation of the suffering too. I understand that it's not fun to dwell on cancer. Morbid posters covering train stations and bus stops probably wouldn't be very popular, but since just talking to one person who knew how I was feeling helped me, I want to convey, with similar honesty, what it's like to find out your mom has cancer, not be able to make her feel better, and watch her go through painful and drawn-out chemotherapy. Absolutely horrible. And I had to accept that it was horrible, and there was no way it wasn't going to be horrible. It just was, and that was that. And it was going to get way worse before it got better. The worries I had early on were small compared with what I faced in person when I went home in the summer. It was easiest for me when Mom was in bed all day after each weekly chemo treatment because I felt like she was safe there. The illness and pain felt somewhat contained, and I could visit her periodically and bring her what she asked for. Between treatments, when there was a semblance of normalcy to our lives, I was constantly worried. I hated that she was so uncomfortable when we were just trying to go about our normal lives out and about in the world. When Mom sometimes got tired or had stomach aches when we went shopping, I felt like maybe I knew what it felt like to be a mother, like she had always been. For the first time, I was worrying more about someone else than I was about myself. I wanted to do anything I could to make her feel better, anything she asked. The pain wasn't just physical. If Mom's cancer was emotionally traumatic for me, I can't imagine how she felt, even as I was understanding her in other new ways. I was in the same room or the next room from her most of the time that I was home, but being of actual aid to her felt impossibly out of reach. Sitting and talking to her reminded us both that she was a person, not just a patient. Sometimes just my fetching her a glass of water made her smile. Still, I couldn't take her suffering away completely. That was what the chemo toxins pumped into Mom were for, even though those toxins were making her feel so unwell in the process. Everything I did was inadequate. She was still in pain. If Mom read that, I can imagine the look she would give me. She'd tell me not to feel bad, that I'm as helpful as I can be, to not worry. When I talked about feeling useless against cancer with Brody, she reminded me that we are not medical professionals. It's not our job to make our moms better. Distracting them from their symptoms with conversations, jokes, and drinks of water is the best that we can do. I think this was especially true for Mom, who seemed to want to forget her cancer as much as possible. Mom is somewhat private, and she didn't want to share everything she was going through. It was just not in her nature to embrace her hair loss, so she couldn't. But why should she have to? There is the archetype of the chemotherapy patient shaving their hair off, nipping that trauma in the bud. I even told Mom I would shave my hair off too as a statement of solidarity, so she wouldn't feel alone in being bald. That was the brave thing to do, right? What I learned from Mom is that there are all kinds of bravery, and she chose to show hers in a different way. Instead of shaving her head, Mom wore a cold cap to try and save her hair from the harsh effects of chemo, and her effort to save her hair is just as admirable as shaving it would have been. It's noble to hide how depleted chemo makes you feel. So there were no fireworks when Mom's last chemo treatment finally took place this last December. Mom and I talked about how we had assumed normalcy would return to our lives straight away, and we were unsettled when it didn't. My whole family continues to come to terms with indestructible Mom's capacity to become ill. The reality that the same person who looked after us all, always, and clothed and fed me without a qualm, could become so sick was difficult and awful to admit. But we're at the start of a new year, and that time has been fundamental to easing the heartbreaking impact cancer had on our family and helping me see it a bit differently. Now that her human vulnerability has been revealed to me, indestructible Mom is even more so. We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Romani Arismith, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or question, please call 919-832-5138.